the part of us that's so busy off solving everything, creating everything, trying to be competent, trying to be on top, trying to look great to everybody else, is the immature part of us. It's the ego in us. And it's as the ego dies, or at least settles down and gets in the back seat, we find what we most need. And I think an honest marriage helps us get there.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Welcome to the Next Level Dentist podcast. We have an extremely special guest today who is a good friend of mine, my wife. A friend of ours. My wife made sure that I have this book here. We made a little memorial book, you can't see it, of our trip to Italy and Switzerland. And she's like, there's a picture of us with Dr. Jennifer from Nation Fife here. You need to, it's like not visible, not very good podcast material. But we got to go on a couples retreat that you hosted along with your team in Northern Italy and Switzerland about a year and a half ago when our marriage was at a really rough spot, and it was an incredible experience. And this was after having discovered your work through some podcasts and some friends. And we didn't expect to need this retreat as much as we ended up needing this retreat. It was one of those where no matter how dark things got, and maybe there was a separation, Christine hadn't asked me to cancel the Switzerland trip. So I knew that our marriage, like there was hope. There was a glimmer of hope because she wasn't asking for a refund on the upcoming trip. And so I think for us, we were incredibly grateful for that landmark experience, for your work that you've done around helping couples find intimacy and love despite drifting, despite challenges. And I don't know, I'm so grateful to have you on the show. I feel like I've done an awful job introducing you. Do you mind introducing yourself a little bit?
Well, sure. So I'm Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife. And as you said, Richard, I have made the focus of my work, I have a PhD in counseling, but I've made the focus of my work really just helping couples to forge richer relationships, more intimate relationships. And I think for many of us, we think this should just be obvious, or all you need is a marriage license and good intentions. And if you chose the right person, this should come pretty easily. But I think our marriages reveal us and reveal our vulnerabilities. And if we can utilize them and understand that that's what they will do and grow ourselves up in the face of what we see, right? We have the ability to really create an intimate friendship, which I think is so valuable if you have the good fortune of marrying someone who's willing to do that as well. And if you yourself are willing to grow in the face of what's revealed, you know, you can really create probably one of the most precious things humans can have, a loving, living marriage, a marriage that's alive. So I love teaching, I love helping them see how they can grow. And I love watching people go through that process. It's very satisfying to see the way that people get happier, get more anchored in their souls when they create something richer in their marriages.
Well, and what you're not saying as you say this is that sometimes to get to that other side of what's possible in a marriage, there's a lot of painful growth and self-confrontation. And it was incredible to go on a couples retreat and to look around the room. There was something about like being 13 to 17 years into your marriage. Like as everyone around the room, it just felt like everyone was in this, 12 to 20 years into marriage. And things just weren't the same. And they had reached the point where it's like enough is enough. And we're going to talk about this within the context of dentistry here in a minute. But as every couple went around the room and shared real, honest, raw struggles over these 10 days, we got this sense that, man, everyone's marriage is kind of messy behind the scenes. And actually, even though to other people, ours might look like really, really hard in certain ways, to us, it's like, okay, at least I like our version of messy.
Yeah, we don't have that problem, you know?
But there was also this like relief in knowing, oh, everyone struggles. And it's not just like light, like, oh, sometimes we fight about where we're going to go out to dinner. there is real dynamics. And so the funny thing is, as you introduce how much you love doing this, you also love throwing wrenches into a couple's dynamic because they're stuck. And then helping them come back together. I remember there was couples on our trip that you cracked open for them dynamics that they've been hiding, where one spouse was like kind of looking down on the other spouse the entire marriage and had never never realized that like they were the problem. They thought, okay, why doesn't this, why doesn't my husband come up to my level?
Why isn't she or he getting it together? Exactly. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes. And so anyways, I could go on and on and on about the experience we had on our couples retreat and how amazing it was. I've been reading your new book that just came out, That We Might Have Joy. And fundamentally, I realized that marriage is hard. I don't know why it took me so long to figure this out, but marriage is a people growing machine, as Dr. Mm-hmm. Schnarch would say, and it's hard. Mm-hmm. And I think as I've opened up with more and more dentists, so I now have a men's group within dentistry where we're working on being physically fit, but also morally confronting ourselves, working on our habits, our addictions, our struggles, but being honest and admitting where we're broken and how we can improve. And as I've leaned into this and helped other men, I've noticed some patterns around dynamics in marriages. And I think especially, you know, I can't speak to what it's like to be a female dentist. I think there's some unique challenges to patients thinking you're an assistant or a hygienist all the time, or kind of downplaying your recommendations, or leading a team of female assistants, hygienist team members as a female doctor. I know there's all these dynamics that I can't firsthand speak to. But in terms of men in dentistry, husbands in dentistry, I've seen some dynamics around this idea of being the provider, the doctor who's made all these sacrifices and spent all this time. And now in your workplace setting, your entire world revolves around you. I mean, literally, you manage the schedule so that every minute of the doctor's time, of the dentist's time, is precisely, you know, used. So they're in the right rooms at the right times, and the whole thing circles around that. And that dynamic can be toxic when applied into a marriage or a relationship.
Yeah.
What dynamics have you seen come from this sense of like a well-regarded, ego-filled provider type role from a husband or a spouse, and maybe another spouse who either is at home or in like a role that just isn't moving the needle a bunch, it's not in the limelight a bunch, and there is kind of this role dynamic in terms of breadwinning.
So I think, so first of all, there are very likely gender differences around that. And whether it's biology or socialization, I think that masculinity, or the idea of what it is to be a desirable man, is to be someone who's competent, who's in control, who is able to do things that provide care, provide protection. And that people, I mean, I think probably what a lot of younger men imagine is, when I've really succeeded, I have that respect, I'm able to create a world that's safe and good and so on. And there's a lot of value in that. I mean, there genuinely is. And I think sometimes we have been too critical of masculinity as a problem, as opposed to understanding how much strong masculinity benefits a family, a society. And that competency, whether male or female, as a dentist, you know, competency and a clear system that's set up to allow you to execute your good judgment and gifts in a situation, it's all very valuable. I think where it can be tricky, though, is, of course, our ego needs get hyper involved. You know, I mean, it's partly what drives us to go do hard things and to build competency and build a practice and so on. But it's not great for a marriage, okay? Because in a marriage, often masculine and feminine come together. That is to say, masculine traits and feminine traits kind of are attracted to each other. There's ways in which I have more masculine traits than my husband. Other ways he has more masculine traits than me. But that is to say, we have a kind of complementarity, right? And that's very typical in a marriage. And so the problem with it is that often the masculine traits we can consider to be superior to the feminine traits. So this is my long way of getting to the idea that if you have a system at work in which everyone is revolving around you and thinks you're great and does everything you say because it's their job and they won't get paid if they don't, but also they may be happy being the supporter and they may think you are great, right? The dentist they're working with and so on. They also aren't trying to raise kids with you, share a life with you, share a bed with you. They're just in a very limited context in a dynamic with you that's working for both people often. And so that can feel really, really good to the ego. And then you go home and your spouse is like, no, like you haven't been here enough and the kid and can you step it up as a father? And, you know, and you're not getting met with, tell me where to jump and how high and which thing you need.
Right.
You're not getting that. And so it can be very easy to resent the validation and ego stroking you imagined you might get in your marriage, but you do get at work, and to start resenting that and bringing your worst self to the marriage, right? Or just your lesser self there, and bringing your best self to work. And so it can be, you know, often what develops us is invalidation, is our egos not getting what they crave. And so in the work environment you're talking about, Richard, it's very easy to get it, you know, and to not have the challenge often that you need, and the marriage is there ready to challenge you. So, yeah.
Well, and I mean, I'll throw myself under the bus here. I had a business that, you know, we were doing multiple offices. I was, you know, leading this. I had this podcast. On paper, everything looked really good and enviable. And I was miserable, and I would come home so stressed after a long day of surgery or patient complications or dealing with a team member drama, or I'd have to let a doctor go or something would happen. And Christine would ask, like, how was your day? Tell me about your day, trying to connect with me. And it was so stressful that I didn't want to relive it. All I wanted to do was to withdraw and cope and self-soothe in largely unhealthy ways, in, you know, stare at my phone, video games, and late at night pornography. And that was a problem. That was hurting my management of my relationship to stress, was hurting our marriage. And on top of that, I think she also knew that, like, I wasn't coping well, and that even though things looked good on the surface, I wasn't happy. And so it was almost this, like, I can pretend to have my crap together when I'm at work, when everyone's validating me. And then when I come home, the truth is I'm not doing well in a lot of the areas that really, really matter to me. And she knows that. And she's one of the only people that knows that. And so over time, there became kind of this distance of, like, the kids are finally in bed. You're going to go watch Downton Abbey. I'm going to go play a video game over here. And then, you know, we're sleeping in separate beds because there's a newborn and X, Y, Z. And there was just this drift that was compounded by how I was unhealthily coping. And that was the dynamic that evolved. And it was this weird combination of, like, everyone else thinks I'm awesome, but you know the truth. And I don't want to confront that truth. I'm not doing well, and I'm not doing well in all these ways, but I don't feel, I feel stuck. And that led to kind of this crisis of, like, something needs to change, where our marriage finally kind of came to a screeching halt of, I have to reprioritize everything because I'm putting everything at risk.
Yeah, 100%. I just think that captures what happens in so many marriages. And yeah, you know, sometimes we're like, you know, the person having the emotional affair or the sexual affair is, you know, my wife doesn't understand me or my spouse doesn't understand me. When the reality is often they understand you way too well. And that's the problem. It doesn't mean that they validate you, but they, as you're saying, Richard, they see your lesser self. They see your limitations much more clearly because in curated environments, you can bring your best self. You can bring a more regulated self in some ways because they only know certain parts of you. And so a marriage can be very, very revealing and very challenging because of that, and therefore easy to use work or whatever context to kind of escape the exposures of the marriage. And we do this so readily.
So how do we get out of that cycle of it's really invalidating because my wife, my spouse knows the worst of me and I'm not coping well? You know, you talk about people doing the work of getting honest with themselves and seeing themselves and being okay with themselves. And this men's group that I run, we hold people accountable in our group, the dentists mm-hmm. in our group, to wake up early, to get their spiritual work done, to mm-hmm. be honest with the group and be vulnerable, to work on their addictions and all of that. And as mm-hmm. they build some momentum on these daily habits, on their physical health, it translates in the ability to receive feedback from the group, from a spouse and all of that. So we've got this little microcosm where it's like, I see men starting to change in this way and overcome some of their demons and their struggles and then be able to enter their marriage from a different spot. Mm. Where have you seen good places for people to kind of like navigate this of like, especially men, I feel like often they don't even know what they're feeling. They would rather run towards something than sit in the anxiety, mm-hmm, pain, mm-hmm. depression. And that is mm-hmm. oftentimes from the male half of the marriage. A lot of the problem is that there's a lot of numbing out. There's a lot of running away. There's a lot of lack mm-hmm. of awareness. I can't be intimate or vulnerable with my spouse if I'm not even aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, where would you start? Where do you tell men to start if they're like, I know I need to work on myself, but I feel kind of broken?
Well, what I would say is that it's very easy to avoid the places of exposure and pain. You know, humans need growth to thrive, but growth can be challenging because it basically means stepping into our incompetency. It means stepping towards what we haven't yet mastered. And we instinctively resist it because we feel more vulnerable there often. And so when our spouse is upset with us, most of us spend most of our time resenting that they're upset because we don't feel appreciated for all the good things we do, right? Yeah. And or that they don't understand our perspective and don't see things the same way. And so our ego is so busy basically fending off the very thing we need to move toward. Mm. And a lot of times if we don't feel great about ourselves or we're afraid of the invalidation, then we just try to shut it off. When what actually helps us is to go towards that data. Mm. And so, you know, as I think Carl Jung said, you know, what we most need is hiding where we least want to look. And it's often in our spouse's point of view and experience, which is not to say that everything they say is the true picture of us, but that it's not avoiding the marriage, that the marriage is a context that can facilitate our ability to move into more sound, anchored souls. Because the part of us that's so busy off, you know, solving everything, creating everything, trying to be competent, trying to be on top, trying to look great to everybody else, is the immature part of us. It's the ego in us. And it's as the ego dies, or at least settles down and gets in the back seat, you know, we find what we most need. And I think an honest marriage helps us get there, but it requires our honesty, our self-honesty, our honesty with the other. It's much easier to seek validation from a patient or a coworker or, you know, to tell a friend how bad you've got it in your marriage than to go in toward the marriage and start talking more honestly about the pain or how you've been a part of the pain or what it is that needs to be addressed. That's hard. And so we love avoiding it. And so, you know, if I were to say, I think maybe we already do talk about marriage this way, but I think we need to reinforce it because I think a lot of us think of marriage as going to provide us with something, you know, reassurance, security, love, validation, rather than we're promising to bring our best self to it. And the gift is the result of doing that. The gift of a marriage is that process of being invested in that process, but not, you know, a lot of times we're rolling our eyes when our spouse and we're telling a friend or whatever, rather than, no, what it is to really be true to a marriage is to stay in that struggle, to stay in that conversation with the invalidating other, and to keep growing from what is revealed about you in it.
Okay, so what, and this is one of the things I'm always focusing on is like, okay, what is the actual application of this? And I, from what you just said, I have a proposal that you can shoot down. So maybe a very useful exercise might be to go to your spouse and admit something that you're struggling with that you really you haven't talked about or you haven't owned up to. So it's like, hey, you know what? I know you probably already know this, but I'm struggling with this. I'm struggling and I'm figuring it out. I'm not doing it perfectly. I really want your help, but I also want your perspective. Like, where do you see, where are my blind spots? Like, where do I need to step it up in this area with this thing that I'm struggling with? And the hard part is that often requires change or sacrifice or admitting and humbling ourselves. But I think this might be, you know, I asked the question, where do we go to do the work to learn about ourselves and be willing to confront ourselves? Just bring this up and try this with the spouse of admit, I know I am failing in this area in our relationship or personally or coping with stress or bringing things home or not making decisions and leading in the home. I kind of check out mentally and let you handle all these things. Do you see that? And how is this a problem? How is this showing up for you?
Yeah.
You might get more out of that conversation than like 10 hours of therapy.
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, yes, you're speaking to one possibility that's important, which is to go in and to kind of acknowledge what you know is contributing to your spouse's unhappiness. And to step right toward it rather than hoping they don't notice or imagining the fantasy that if you don't bring it up, that it's not really happening or something. You know, one of the things you said in the beginning is like, sometimes I threw a monkey wrench into people's dynamic. And what I would actually say about that is they were already living out the monkey wrench.
Yes.
I just helped to reveal it because then they're more able to deal with it, you know? And that's an important idea for me because the thing is, we're already living out our conflicts. It's just when they're underground, we can't deal with them. Then if we get them into relief, in front of us, then we're more able to choose. Our agency increases. Our ability to choose better goes up. And we think, oh, if I just don't acknowledge that it's there, then it won't really be there. And instead, we're just living it rather than being able to make choices with it.
Well, it's the there's so many dental analogies here of the dental cavity that's not hurting, that's there, that if it goes unaddressed, will turn into a root canal, will turn into infection, or an infection that an abscess that is growing painlessly, like it needs to be cleaned out, it needs to be taken care of, and it's often painful and there's some recovery and, you know, it doesn't feel good.
Right.
But it's going to feel worse if you don't take care of
it. Exactly. But going towards it actually limits your pain. So unless you're way into pain, you know, the sooner you go toward it, the better.
Yeah.
The better for limiting how much we suffer. And yes, we have to take the suffering kind of more upfront, you know, because to pull out that drill or whatever, it doesn't feel good. But, you know, you ultimately limit your pain if you go toward it. And so the other thing I would say is like a kind of take home idea is resentment. Like resentment is kind of our way of feeling superior to a problem, but not addressing it. I think resentment is often this kind of like, I can feel angry and even
good about it.
Embittered. Yeah. But like in some way better than you because you do this terrible thing and I don't do it. And I can take a kind of cold comfort in feeling like I'm the good one who's being put upon in this marriage. But it's a way of like not having to actually go toward it and address it. Mm. And I think we should use resentment as like red flags because it festers and it's destructive. And if I'm resenting something, I either need to grow up and self-confront and recognize I'm being unfair in my resentment or I'm playing a role in this problem and deal with my role. Mm. And or I need to go have an honest conversation and renegotiate the terms or renegotiate what we're doing. But I need to deal with it like an adult, you know, like a grown up. But it takes courage. And so that's why we love resentment and victimhood.
And it feels good. It like feels good to be angry in this way of like, I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah.
And I know that and I'm going to hold that against you. But I know you're not going to admit it, so I'm not even going to bring it up. I'm just going to secretly resent you the whole time.
Yes, and I'm going to either go tell my friends about it and get them to be allies in it, or just shove it down and go look at porn or do something else that kind of is I can often justify my dishonesty with you around this resentment. So it's also valuable to look at how does this resentment serve me? Like, what does it justify in me? What does it allow me to avoid? Often it's our own participation in the problem. You know I strongly prefer just feeling self-righteous. Because then when you go into the conversation, you're like, ooh, yeah, okay, maybe I have something to do with this. Maybe I'm a part of this dynamic. And so it often pressures our growth. Hey everyone, as you know, I've been talking a lot about Cozy Earth products recently, and I'm telling you, I love their products. It's something to do with this viscose made from bamboo that just gives a breathability and softness to the clothing they make, to the sheets, to the new beach towels that I just received from them and that I love, because there is a softness to them that's just different than any other product I've used. My husband asked me recently if I'm selling my soul to start promoting a product on my podcast since that's new for me. And I said, if I am, it's completely worth it because I seriously love these things. So if you're needing beach towels, check out Cozy Earth's beach towels. And if you're wanting new sheets, you can use them for 100 days with free returns. So you can try them out, see if you love them as much as I do. Cozy Earth stands behind everything they make. And a 10-year warranty in addition to that 100 nights of hassle-free returns. Made from viscose from bamboo, breathable, soft, and built for summer, head to cozyearth.com and use my code JFF20 for an exclusive 20% off. That's code JFF20 for an exclusive 20% off. And if you see a post-purchase survey, mention that you heard about Cozy Earth right here.
You brought up earlier one of the topics that I sent you a list of topics, and one of them was emotional and physical affairs in dentistry. I've seen that over time as dentists don't cope well and manage their own experience and emotions, they either lead toward imploding of like just kind of crumpling under the stress of it all. And we just did 5 episodes on suicide in dentistry. That was the first 5 episodes of the season. And the other side is they blow their life up or some combination of addiction and crumpling and ruining things. And it's messy and it's hard and it creates a lot of consequences to violate a promise and a marriage and all of these things. And the setting of a dental office where there's a male dentist tends to be more female employees. There's a lot of time together. There's a lot of close quarters, just like a hospital setting in medicine, you know, very similar. You're working elbow to elbow all day long, oftentimes with members of the opposite sex, and building trust and all of those things. And there might be validation that occurs there that doesn't occur at home. There might be connection, there might be novelty, all those things. And I want to be sure that, like, as we're candidly talking about this, like, this is one of my realizations is that men have such power to hurt their spouse and their children and blow up their own life. And I don't know why that was such an epiphany to me, that, like, I have more capacity to hurt my own family than someone off the street. You know, you're walking down a dark alley and I got to protect my family against these evil outside forces. The reality is, if my addictions or pornography or these things that I'm not coping with progress, I can be of more danger to everyone that I love well-being. The most. And so I want to approach this conversation first from a prevention side of things. What are some safeguards that we can put in, anyone can put in place into their marriage to make sure that we're not opening the door to emotional affairs, physical affairs? And,
you know, I think it's challenging in a lot of ways, because I do think we create intimacy with the people that we're working alongside. And especially if we have a shared goal and a shared project, you really get close to the people quite intuitively when you're trying to solve something together. You know, like men in a foxhole in war, you know, they become like brothers because you're really there trying to solve something as a team. And, you know, probably when families lived out on the frontier, I don't mean to like say there's anything, you know, I don't want to over gloss those realities. I'm sure they were very, very hard, but at least there was a sense that you were working together to stay alive.
Right.
And as women are often home and men are in the workforce, or both are in the workplace, but they're in different domains, you know, it can be really easy to create intimacy with the ones you're working alongside. And, you know, there's a certain amount of that that's totally fine. You're going to build friendships. You're going to build strong relationships with the people you work with. But the preventative part is both understanding the implicit vulnerability of it and not being naive to it, right? And not one of the things that you can kind of push yourself on is that you don't ever start sharing things with a coworker, you know, that you're attracted to, that you wouldn't, how to say it, that you start sharing things with them that you're not sharing with your spouse. Or that you're seeking them out in a separate way to have conversations and connection that's not public or something you would do with any of your coworkers. So you start building a kind of secret connection. I mean, by secret, like, you, there's something you don't want others to be privy to, especially your spouse. So if you can't imagine your spouse right there being perfectly comfortable with the conversation you're having, then there's something off.
I love that indicator of any sort of hiding or secrecy or the desire to, like, not have that be seen is a massive red flag. And so that's a line in the sand of, I'm not going to interact with anyone in a way that I would feel like I need to hide this from my spouse. And, you know, I came out and said, as a new practice owner, when I bought my dental practice, I just have a policy of not sharing car rides or going to lunch with a team member alone. And that's just like, and by even just by saying that, it's kind of like putting out in the open, like, hey, I'm conscious.
Yeah, like, it's not personal. I just don't do it.
I just don't do it. Here's a dynamic that can occur, and I want to kind of create some boundaries and know that you guys know that I'm conscious of those boundaries, and I want to respect that. And then I think what you just said of, am I being sneaky? Am I hiding?
Right.
Am I texting someone that my wife would be upset if she read the text?
If they saw the interaction. Exactly.
So so on the other side of that, I before my group, I was in this other group called Superhuman Fathers. And actually, that's where I discovered you on the Stoic Dad podcast. I think you got talked over in that podcast more than almost any other podcast you've been in. It was so funny.
They were great.
they were talking over you and it was a great interview, but I saw a lot of men in that group. So this was a non-dental setting who had cheated on their spouse. They had made these choices, and in that group, men held each other to a high standard and said, you need to tell your spouse this. And they had to go into these conversations. And I've seen dentists like blow up their lives in this way. I've seen, you know, there's no faster way to ruin your professional and personal life than sleep with a hygienist or a dental assistant. And I've seen dentists do that, ruin very quickly everything they've built. That moment of, okay, I need to own the truth. I need to tell the truth. I need to own the consequences of that. Oftentimes leads to divorce. It oftentimes leads to, very reasonably, the marriage might not have been well before, and now there is a very clear fork in the road and good reason for your spouse to leave. And so these men were working on themselves in the face of that. Like, okay, I'm trying to be a better man.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell the truth. My spouse might leave me. This might get really ugly and really hard for a long time.
Yeah.
But I still need to show it for me. I still need to do what's right. I need to get right with God. Yeah. I need to be a better man for my children. And in some ways, seeing that side of things was very inspirational for, like, okay, these men are willing to tell the truth even when the truth is damning.
Hard. Yeah.
Sometimes it worked out. Sometimes they were able to own up to it and move forward. And these days I see a lot of the moment that there's any sort of problems in this realm, the immediate reaction is like divorce, separate, leave him. Once a cheater, always a cheater, those types of thing. In your work, have you seen hope for couples that have been through infidelity, that one partner has been unfaithful to the other and created all that pain and suffering? Do they come out on the other side if they're willing to lean in?
They can. They certainly can, which is not to say that they always do. I've certainly seen marriages end over it, but it had more to do with how the infidelity was handled than the infidelity itself. I'm not minimizing infidelity. I mean, if anything's been a protector for me of doing something like that, it's watching what people go through, because it is utter hell to go through that devastating blow to a marriage. But I would say that a lot of times what drives infidelity is immaturity. It's ego dependency. What I mean is it's dependency on ego reinforcement. You know, oftentimes infidelity is driven more by anger and hostility towards one's marriage partner than it is about the desire for sex. So that is to say, I'm angry about the validation I don't get here, about the loneliness that I feel with you, even though I'm a part of that problem. And I can justify finding it here because I don't get it at home. And so a lot of times our anger about the ego reinforcement we don't get makes it easier to justify the secrecy, the deception, and the breach in the marriage. What happens when a marriage is able to recover is that the person that, well, let me start with the person who created the breach in the marriage. It's such a blow, not only to the marriage, but to their own sense of themselves. Like, I don't respect who I've become, what I'm doing. I can't live with myself being this needy, this willing to lie, this willing to do something destructive to my marriage and my family. And I have to change. And it's, yes, I want the marriage to survive, but I can't control that.
Right.
And whatever happens, I have to become a better person. I have to become someone I can respect at the end of this. So they use that devastating experience to truly transform. And as much as crisis sucks, it's when the brain gets the most neuroplastic and when people are most able to change, is when they realize I've burned it to the ground and I have to do something qualitatively different. And so that's usually when people make massive, or they are able to make massive steps in their maturation. And so they go from being dependent upon reinforcement to getting none of it and actually utilizing that lack of reinforcement because their spouse is devastated and upset with them, as is anybody else that is aware. And they use that deep invalidation to create a deeper self-validation, a deeper source of integrity within themselves that allows them to become a more trustworthy soul, even to themselves. They become less needy. They become more able to deal with hard things. And usually when marriages thrive is that the spouse that was faithful or that didn't cheat is also willing to look at themselves in the immature dynamic. That's different than saying they had it coming to them or that they, you know, obviously they don't control anyone's choices but their own. But often to look at, I can see how I was hard to talk to. I can see how I was participating in a marriage that was not very honest and alive. Whatever their role may have been in the immature marriage, they are also willing to grow and not just be in a simple blaming stance, right? And those are the marriages that really do transform and become qualitatively better. When they don't, it's when people are too busy trying to get the other one to trust them, for example. The one who was unfaithful is more interested in proving that they've changed than in changing, in getting the other one to be happy with them rather than in getting to a place of being honestly at peace with themselves. That they are willing to kind of shy away from what's real if it's ugly and not really get down to the core of what's real about themselves. You know, and then on the opposite side of that, if someone's been cheated on, they prefer the punishment position. Now, I understand a certain amount of punishment is a very intuitive response to someone who betrays and someone who lies to you. But it becomes a replacement from growing and really either stepping fully back into a trustworthy marriage or stepping out of it entirely. And so that would be the other half of keeping the immaturity alive. So it requires a lot to turn it into something better, but it's definitely the way to go if you want to limit suffering in your life.
Well, and I remember you saying at the retreat, because this had come up with a couple that brought up a question, and you said, you know, one of the types of couples that I'm least excited to work with is the couple who comes and says, our marriage is pretty good, but we want it to be better. Mm. And that dynamic is often really hard because neither of them is willing to change or to self-confront because there's not enough pain to do so.
Yeah, yeah.
And that,
yeah.
But in crisis, when a couple is really at this junction of like, we're either going to make this work or we're going to separate. That all of a sudden people are willing to change. And, you know, from what I saw, the ones that had a glimmer of hope was where the one who was unfaithful said, I'm going to do 95% of work on myself. Yeah. And if you can just be patient and try and give me another chance and we can create a new dynamic and a new relationship, that maybe there's hope. Yeah. And sometimes it worked out and sometimes it didn't. I think another really powerful concept that came out of what you said and some of the work we did on that retreat was this idea that divorce being a real option is an important thing, because if it's not, then if you can't choose out, then neither of the spouses are choosing in. It's just like, it's too painful. We're not going to divorce. Divorce is not on the table. And I think, you know, to transition from the topic we just had, when someone cheats on someone else, divorce is a very real, very justifiable option.
Yes. Response. Yes.
Unfortunately, it shouldn't take that severe of a thing for divorce to be on the table. And that's very paradoxical to like what I was given growing up. Like it was the D word. Like we don't talk about that. That is something that is not on the table explicitly. Like that was what I was taught was you get married and you treat it as if divorce is not an option. Why is it healthy, despite wanting to make every marriage work, and there is potential for so much good to come out of really leaning into any marriage, why is it healthy to like have that perspective that divorce is on the table?
It's a little bit paradoxical what I'm about to say, but yes, Like, on the one hand, I think as a society, we do best to take commitment seriously, like to not be flippant about our commitments, to take the commitment of marriage and parenting very seriously, which is different than saying that divorce is never an option, or that I don't continue to be a chooser throughout the marriage and throughout my life. Because as soon as we start to treat marriage like it's a prison, like we have to be there, we don't actually have the choice, then the commitment in some sense basically loses its value because it's not a self-authored position. I've told this story before, but like the day before I got married, I kind of suddenly went back into a panic, like, oh my gosh, like, you know, because I was afraid, like, if I get married, then I'm throwing away my agency. I'm folding into someone else's life. And some of those old ideas for me just kind of came back, like I was going to lose control of something, lose myself. And I just remember, you know, getting to a calmer place inside of my head and just said, you know, I reserve the right to leave if it ever becomes the most right thing to do. You know, I feel good about this commitment. I'm putting both feet in. I'm putting my whole heart into this commitment. But if John ever becomes unworthy of that commitment because of his own choice or something, I will do what is the most right thing, as painful as that might be. So that is to say, like, we can, knowing that we're not there because we're just afraid of the alternative, that's not really a commitment either. Like, I can't even consider the possibility because I couldn't handle the social judgment or that I'm too afraid to live on my own. That's not really a forward-looking commitment. That's more like I'm clinging on to something because I'm afraid. And so, yes, this ability to say yes is highly dependent on our capacity to say no, that I could say no to this. That means saying yes to this marriage is actually an act of self-authorship. An act of self. And I think that's where marriages are their strongest and their happiest, is when you can truly bring your full self to it, right? In all of its imperfection.
And that is where the prison, you talked about the prison of, I think especially when there is like, not especially, but in the context of a dentist lifestyle, you have a certain kind of status in your community. You're a business owner, you're a leader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You build up a lifestyle of a home and comforts that you're used to. There can be this mm-hmm. sense of like, to get divorced would be so painful, not only spiritually, religiously, for our children, but also we've mm-hmm. kind of created a lifestyle that is a prison.
Yeah.
For us. There's a lot of financial pressures, and it would be incredibly difficult and painful to split, which it is. It unequivocally is.
Definitely is.
But it is still, if that, I like how you phrased it, which is, if that is the next right thing to do, then mm-hmm. to have the courage to do that. And in the meantime, mm-hmm. I'm all in. And yeah. I'm really hoping that's never the next right choice.
Yes, exactly.
So shifting exactly. gears here, one of the dynamics that came up at our couples retreat, and I keep going back to the retreat, it was just so mm-hmm. good. For me, the concept that I heard from you, I also heard this from Zach Spafford. So he has a podcast mm-hmm. and a counseling business around overcoming pornography. And I worked with Zach for a year. And this concept of sex is not a need. And this has come up in my group, in the men's group that I was in before. And it's almost like some people really, really bristle.
Oh, yeah, they get upset.
And in fact, there was a man on the retreat who...
Oh, yeah.
and we're good friends, and we've talked since. He's like, yeah. You just gave my wife a loaded gun. Like,
yeah.
When you say that. But the frame and the frame of this group that I was in, one of the mottos was, do the most, need the least. Superhuman fathers, next level fathers. This is one of these mm-hmm. themes of do the most, need the least. And in fact, mm-hmm. that stepping into the masculine involves a degree of self-sacrifice. And I think of mm-hmm. Someone gave the example of their immigrant parent who really worked two jobs for years and years and years to create a better mm-hmm. life for his family, and how much he respected him and he loved him and he didn't complain. Mm. He didn't You know, and it's not to say we're not allowed to have needs. Mm. I was a missionary for 2 years. You know, there was a period of my life where like sex is not a need. You don't die if you don't have sex. And with that dynamic, it is as a man to then say, okay, this is my need. It's your responsibility to fill that need. And you're the only person, you know, that I'm authorized to have sex with. So I need sex. You're the only person who can provide it. So I'm coming to you. Versus I want to be with you and connect with you at whatever level you're able to connect with. And if that's intimacy, if that's sex, great. If not, I want to be with you and I want to connect with you on any given day, on any given week. Has been a useful framework because in terms of pornography and struggling with some of these coping issues, to say like, no, this, it's my job to manage myself.
Yeah.
And I want to show up the best version of myself, my marriage. It's not her job to take care of my quote unquote needs.
Exactly. And I would even say one's emotional needs. Like if your wife is talking about her emotional needs, I would challenge that idea. And people are like, wow, like you don't get it. But to just explain, I do believe that sex is very important. And I think it's a very important part. I should say, not just sex, but physical intimacy, like the ability to share an intimate, full-bodied relationship is really important to a happy marriage. That said, when we approach it as if it is a need, and specifically a male need, we interfere with creating that. That is to say, if you've got to have this physical release and I'm the only legitimate provider of that physical release, then this isn't about me. This isn't about your passion for me. This isn't about us creating something together. And so then it actually, that framing, which again is not to minimize men's sexuality at all. It's a great part of a relationship, the sexuality of men, right? So, but if when we put it in that frame, we actually undermine creating what I think most of us want, which is to feel desired, to feel passion, to feel energy towards us. And so we, you know, I don't think, just let's go with like a stereotypical wife who's talking about her emotional needs. If you get your husband to listen to you because you've convinced him you have a need, but he doesn't really want to listen to you, it doesn't really solve it, does it?
Right.
I mean, it's more like, now that's different than saying like, look, it really helps me if you're willing to kind of understand my experience. A husband could say, okay, let me try and get better at that. Let me invest in that. Okay, that's different than I have a need, therefore you have to give me this. Okay, that's a more childish frame, a parent-child frame. And when we put that into a marriage, we often do it because we want the perceived security, but we actually undermine the freedom and ease and honesty of the marriage. And we interfere with choice being at its foundation. And that's really where people are their happiest is, look, you're different than me. But I love you and I choose you and I care about the things that matter to you because I love you. And so I may not like hiking, but you do and I like you. And so let's go on a hike. I mean, that is to say, I care about doing things with you. And so it's going to stretch me and I'm going to grow in ways I might not otherwise. But that's because I'm committed to bringing my best self to this partnership.
Well, and you also have brought up in the past that as soon as there is a neediness to that male sexuality, it puts the wife in a motherly role. I am providing, I am caretaker rather than you are strong and talk to, I feel like I don't have the language.
No, it's 100% true. The maternal energy is anti-sexual for women. What turns women on is to be the turn on, and women, you know, when women talk about, oh, I'm all touched out, to me, that's like, okay, that's not good sex that's happening then. You're trying to provide for your kids all day, and then you're relating to your husband in the same way. If anything, it should be the opposite. You get to surrender into that masculine care at the end of a day of taking care of kids. You get to experience the pleasure of being enjoyed and being given to, right? And a lot of times when we have put it in the need frame, we're pulling for that caretaking and interfering with exactly what's erotic for most men and women, right?
It's funny, like men join my group and they're held accountable to like we're going to get them a six pack and we're going to help them self-confront. We're going to help them lean in and show up consistently spiritually. We're going to give them the safe place to be broken and work on themselves. For some people, leaning into all of those things leads to a lot of intimacy and improvements in their marriage, because they're coming to their spouse and saying, what can I do better? And I know I want to step up. I want to level up in these areas. And sometimes it doesn't move the needle at all. Their spouse doesn't care that they have a six pack. And just because they're acting less needy, the wife is just grateful that, like, okay, finally, thank goodness. Because I don't enjoy sex or, you know, whatever. I think one of the really interesting perspectives was this idea that a lack of intimacy, our ability to communicate and meet in the middle and find intimacy that works, physical intimacy, is this litmus test for the marriage as a whole. So, so if we can't come together and talk about this and create connection and create honesty and feeling seen and validated and loved and pursued and all these things, if this is broken, there's probably other things that are broken as well. Is that how you would phrase it or put it?
Yes. I mean, I think so. Dr. Schnarch, who I trained with, he's no longer with us, but I trained with for about a decade. One of the things that he would often say is that the intimate relationship, the sexual relationship, is a microcosm of the larger relationship. It reveals a lot about the couple, how they are having sex, how they are avoiding sex, you know, like what does it show us about who they are as a couple? And I think that's true. I think it's also true that you can look at a lot of vignettes of how a couple interacts and you can see probably what their intimate relationship is like too. You can kind of, it can kind of go both directions. So yes, I mean, I think there's people that go out and they really refine themselves. They bring a solid self to the marriage, but they don't find a partner. Now, there may be things that they're blind to that they don't see, and that their spouse is saying, you're so into your six pack, but you're not as into me as you think. You just want me to admire you and desire you, but I don't feel your investment. So it could be that, that it's still just about them. But let's say they're really bringing their earnest, honest, best self. I wish it were a guarantee, but that's the risk of love, and why it's such a gift when you really do have a committed spouse, because you can only control who you are. And it requires two people who are willing to bring their investment and their honesty. That's what an intimate marriage requires. And many good people don't find that in their partner. And it's not their fault. I mean, we want the idea, like, if I maybe did this better or tried harder or whatever, then they would love me. And that's sometimes not true. And sometimes the person doesn't want a partnership. They want maybe to not get divorced, but they don't want the work of partnership and investment in the other. And so sometimes when we talk about marriage, we talk about it more for the creation of family and the kind of building block of society, and all those things matter. But intimate marriage requires a different kind of commitment, a different level of commitment, that this is about you and I working out a partnership, even though we are very different from each other. That's what drives attraction and exactly what makes it like, I love you and I'm attracted to you, but what is the matter with you? Why do you do life the wrong way? I think that's a common feeling in marriage. And but if we can accept that that's a fundamental reality of marriage and lean in anyway, well, then we forge our soul capacity to really love and be loved.
This is like, you control your half of the equation exactly. And I remember you saying, own 100% of what is mine to own and 0% of what is theirs to own. And so often we're doing this dance of compensating for ourselves and for our spouse's insecurities and struggles and needs, and we don't want to be seen and they don't want to be seen. And so we just kind of do this keeping the blinders on dance where we cohabitate and don't grow together. It's hard.
Yeah. It's why there's a lot of unhappy marriages, is because it's easy to do unhappy. Well, it's miserable, but it's easy up front. It's easy to go self-justified and blind.
Well, you know, I feel like there's better notes we could have left it on, but I do so appreciate the work you do, and especially from an LDS framework, from members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who have a lot of baggage around sexuality and all of these things. But your book, your workshops, your men's workshop, I think in particular for my audience, tell us a little bit about that and where they can go to find more about you and your podcast.
Well, first, I want to say that we just opened up enrollment for our 2027 couples tour to New Zealand. We had the great privilege of taking our kids to New Zealand several years ago, and it was truly amazing, a stunning country. We were able to spend several weeks and were on the North Island as well as the South Island. And I'm not exaggerating when I say there was so much natural beauty. I just kept sending pictures home to friends and family. Beautiful black sand beaches, this turquoise water. We went to the fjordlands on the South Island that just have stunning views from both the top of these steep mountains and down in the valley. It's incredible. So when we were deciding where to go in 2027, I told our tour organizer that it was time to go to New Zealand. So it's going to be a remarkable tour. And as Richard said, it's a really powerful investment in a relationship. So each day you'll learn principles that will help you bring your best self to your marriage. You'll connect with other earnest couples, and you'll have the time and space to really connect with your spouse, to have the kinds of conversations that aren't always easy, but are valuable if you want to create something stronger between you.
I think we literally are poster children for that. I think we're on all the ads that are running.
Yes,
because we were interviewed in.
That's right. We have a videographer there and following us around. And that's right.
So if you want my actual endorsement, just look for the ads that are floating around or on the website.
You're right. So we have that. And then in the fall, so I have a men's course called The Art of Loving. And it's really all about how to grow into a more solid self and into a deeper peace with your sexuality and to be more capable of intimate love. And so I have that in an online course. But in the fall, we do a live event in Southern Utah. And as a Latter-day Saint, I've focused a lot of my work for working specifically with Latter-day Saints. But the concepts, just like this conversation today, are very much for just humans trying to sort out how to be better humans. So we have a lot of non-Latter-day Saints that come to our events too. So,
And there's also online courses. Where can people find both your free podcast, your paid podcast, the online courses, the in-person courses? Where should they go?
So my website is just got it all there, finlayson-fife.com. And you can find the free one, the one where I work with couples, the courses, the events. Yeah, it's all there.
Which, as a podcaster, I absolutely love the format of let's change the names and I don't know. Do you change voices ever?
Room for two. Yeah, we distort the voices and change the names of the couples, and then I do work with couples, and so you get to kind of listen in and learn about yourself. Well, some people take the seat of being the therapist and they're like, why is she doing that? And I would do that.
Right.
And then others take the place of like, okay, that's me. That's us in our marriage. I highly recommend the looking at yourself through the couple, because you can see a lot about how you're participating in your marriage challenges by hearing how other humans are doing that. So
That format is so brilliant to me, because it's the thing, if you can bring to someone in a podcast a conversation that they would never get to hear otherwise, that is such a gift. So if anyone is like, what is this subscription podcast? I also wholeheartedly endorse paying for that and getting the behind the scenes look at things. So thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll talk to you next time on the Next Level Dentist podcast.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.